Climate Interactive is a not-for-profit think tank, 11 of us, and we do the math behind climate change, figuring out what it's really going to take to address this challenge. Two of us are here in Asheville. We sit at the Collider over on the fourth floor of the Wells Fargo building, but we're also spread across in New England, and we have some people we work with out on the West Coast as well.
In D.C., are you guys involved in lobbying or anything like that?
We don't do any lobbying. It really is kind of the translation of a lot of the climate science into what's relevant that the media wants to share, that the UN needs to share, that countries need to understand, that activists around the world need to know about what it's going to take to really address this challenge.
I see. Okay. And so you guys are involved in putting together sort of interactive looks at things, like what drew our attention was the thing that you guys had in the New York Times recently,
yeah,
which showed what the effects of certain moves by our president-elect, whether he were to pull out of, you know, the Clean Power Plan or whether he were to pull out of the Paris Agreement, what effect that would have on our carbon emissions. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, the New York Times contacted us and asked if they could get the numbers behind how we would use various legislation and actions by the federal government to address climate change and deliver upon the U.S.'s commitment to reduce emissions 26% below 2005 by 2025. So we gave them numbers, and they have these amazing graphic designers of the Times now, and they made a, it's kind of a swipeable mobile phone story you should go check out. And really the main point of it was showing that there were so many things that the Obama administration had planned to do, and some of them are in jeopardy if people don't defend the commitment of this government to follow through on our international commitments to the UN.
Yeah. And so over the weekend, we had President-elect Trump on Fox News say that he doesn't believe in climate change. He said, I think the quote was, nobody really knows about climate change.
Right.
I think you would probably differ
on
that.
Of course.
So our incoming president doesn't believe in climate change.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, there are two main effects that we should, as citizens of the earth who care about the future, really should be vigilant about. One of them is what we do in this country. As I just mentioned, there's so many things about getting onto renewables and getting away from coal, oil, and gas that we all should be committed to. And so many people in Asheville are doing so much on. So that's our actions. But we need to keep our eyes on the bigger prize is likely international. So a lot of what happens in climate change will be happened through the State Department. So it really is concerning when the ex-CEO of ExxonMobil could be the Secretary of State. The most glaring one right now is there's a $500 billion oil and gas deal that Putin and Russia want to do. It's not happening right now because of sanctions by the U.S. as part of NATO because Russia went into Crimea. So if you were Russia and you really wanted to have a $500 billion deal opened up, you would make sure that there was going to be a president and a secretary of state who were friendly to oil and gas deals. So there's a side of this which is, wow, as citizens, we get to make sure that our government continues to lead the way internationally to make sure we keep coal, oil, and gas in the ground, because that's really the work of addressing climate change.
And tell me a little bit about that $500 billion deal.
Yeah.
Is that we're talking about drilling that would take place up in the Arctic, is that
up
right?
Up in the Arctic, above the Arctic Circle, areas that previously were not accessible, largely because there was so much ice up there. Now it's warming and they're becoming accessible. It, you know, it makes the Standing Rock, like those pipelines, just seem tiny about relative to the scale that Russia could get access to.
Yeah. I'm hearing two different things in the wake of his election. On the one hand, I'm hearing a lot of people who are just terrified.
Yeah.
You know, there was already talk before he was elected that are we past the point of no return when it comes to climate change? And then other people are taking a more positive view and saying, well, you know, he can't do that much damage. What do you think?
I think the best way to look at this is this could be the thing that rallies people to be much more engaged in something that's always required citizen action. And a great example of just what happened here in Asheville lately was a friend of mine, A.K. Benninghoffen, who said, this is kind of crazy. Tomorrow, I'm going to put out coffee and donuts. Anybody who wants to come to my house, get on the phone and call the representatives and say, I want a different future for the climate or for civil rights or whatever you care about. Come to my house. It sounds like tomorrow, she said. Mm-hmm. And 35 people came over and just got on the phones and started calling. And so the kinds of actions that are happening in government, some of our local leaders like Brownie Newman, Holly Jones, Gordon Smith, who for years have been pushing 80% reduction of municipal buildings, 80% reduction in emissions by 2050, making sure that those things happen. People like Dave Hollister at Sundance and Andrea Morris, a couple friends of mine, went out to Standing Rock to support people keeping oil safely in the ground. So think of this change as the spark for all of us, whatever scale we want to work, whatever power we have, however modest. You know, you don't need to be Van Jones to go lead this movement. You need to be whoever you are. And people around around Asheville are doing this right now. Anna Jane Joyner, another friend, reaching out to Christian evangelicals who are working on climate change with bold leadership, because that's a community she has access to.
Yeah. Let me play devil's advocate for a moment. Yeah. So you say that this will be the spark that could rally people. Why wasn't the election itself the spark? Why didn't people get engaged before?
Wow. Why didn't people get engaged before?
And do you really think that they will now? Because I'm sort of seeing, it seems to be like there aren't massive protests anymore. I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but you see things like Black Lives Matter. You'll see things that do take off, like the protests over the Dakota Access Pipeline. Certain things resonate. And I don't really understand what those things are. We had the Keystone XL Pipeline.
Right.
It seems like things that are more tangible, and then climate change itself is this slow burn.
Right, right. So what I think is slowly coming together is a confluence of concerns and issues, because climate change is no longer a greeny environmental issue. This is something that affects people around the world, poor people, people of color, people in cities, and now is connected to other issues. Like, you know, in North Carolina, 10,000 premature deaths in 2010 just from coal emissions. This stuff is killing us directly. Coal emissions killing all those people. And we can see all the impacts from, well, it came together with the Dakota Access Pipeline, where we saw Native Americans coming together with other people along with environmentalists to say, this is an issue that really matters to all of us. So it finally could be the coming together of a variety of concerns that do get people back out into the streets. So that's my greatest aspiration, is that it starts to happen. And there are a lot of people who are pushing for that to happen. These folks, Steffi Rausch and Brad Rouse, two friends of mine at Citizen Climate Lobby, saying we need to have a coal tax and dividend right now as a way to address this. And not just as an environmental concern, but as an economic concern, connecting to all these other issues. This could be the coming together that we really need.
With that data that the New York Times used, you know, our listeners can go and look at that and they can see, here's the impact of this certain thing, this certain thing. Can you talk to some of the specifics of that, like what the impact are? Say the United States doesn't follow through with the Clean Power Plan. It looks like we'll have a 5-4 conservative majority when President Trump takes office and gets his Supreme Court nominee through, as he's expected to do. And the Clean Power Plan was already put on hold. So what happens if we don't have the Clean Power Plan?
Right. Yeah, so there are two forces at work with the Clean Power Plan. One of them is just the theory that, okay, it gets wiped off the books. It was already in jeopardy, and it looked to be about 40% of the reduction that we were expecting to see. And yet we've heard lately from the Sierra Club, connected to those people who helped shut down the Asheville Power Plant, that we were already on track to get many of its benefits because there was so much natural gas that was coming into circulation, and also renewables like wind and solar, and coal companies were going bankrupt anyways. So we were getting many of those benefits that would lead me to believe we're not going to see the full cut of all those emissions reductions that we were hoping to get from clean power plants. So it's a funny time where, oh, we could be really horrible, or actually the market and then actually state level action might deliver much of the results that we were hoping to see anyways.
Let's talk about the Paris Climate Accord.
Yeah.
If the United States pulls out of that, it's conceivable that other countries could go forward, but there could also be this cascade where people say, well, if the United States isn't going to do it, why should we invest all this money and so forth? So looking at that chart that New York Times put out, did that take into account the potential for the cascade of countries pulling out?
Yeah, what a good question. So several months ago, I was in Marrakesh, which was the year after Paris. And there was a lot of concern, like, what about this cascade idea that perhaps other countries would pull out because the U.S. would? One note is that it would take 4 years for the U.S. to pull out of the Paris Agreement. They built it in so that it was relatively impervious to this kind of presidential leadership. But secondly, it's less of a concern about the cascade of people pulling out. It's more of the concern is that this is a time when we need strong leadership. So my concern is that we don't have the U.S. helping forge international deals. That's more the concern, is that we would miss that kind of bold leadership in the opposite direction, say, of this Russian, you know, oil and gas deal that we might see the State Department actually helping.
And the Paris Agreement was meant to be a starting point. You know, it was meant to be strengthened upon in the coming years. And, you know, you mentioned the four-year timeline of countries pulling out, 3 to 4 years, I guess. But wasn't the agreement set up to be largely kind of nudges, like basically they're voluntary, like there's no legal weight behind not doing anything?
All of the pledges, like the U.S. says 26% below, you know, the emissions are going to drop below 2005 levels by that much by 2025. Those are all voluntary. That's one reason they don't have to go through the Senate. So there aren't the teeth internationally. The teeth internationally are more going to be happening through trade deals and through other levels. And so it's not particularly strong that way. So in that sense, I guess the pulling out is not as horrible as you might have feared.
How do you feel? I mean, are you optimistic or are you just trying to put a positive spin as much as you can?
So I'm hopeful, and I take hope not as a forecast, not like, oh, I think we've got this handled. I take hope as a choice. Hope is a decision that you make that, like, I believe in the future. I believe that we are going to do all we can to make things better. And it really, for me, is fueled by what I see brewing around here, all the people who are taking action at whatever level that they can. And really, it's the only option we have is to do all we can to address this challenge that we all are clear about. And it gets clear, like, you remember a couple of weeks ago when we were walked outside and you breathed in and you smelled those forest fires. You're like, this isn't right. What's up with this? And it's always we've had forest fires, but we've had many more in this country due to climate change. They have contributed to them. So it's, I remember 20 years ago, people said, well, we really won't get serious about climate change until something really horrible happens. And then you start paying attention to those forest fires in California and to the heat waves and to all of the storm surges and the flooding in Miami. And now here it is in at our homes over in Gatlinburg, smelling that smoke when you walk out the door. Here it is. I see that rising up in people to say, I'm going to do something. I'm going to take some sort of action. And that gives me the courage to be hopeful. Not the forecast, like we've got this handled, but like, wow, I'm part of a large group of people who are doing something. And the people here in Asheville who are doing something, it's like probably what it was like in Birmingham around the civil rights movement, when people really stood up and said, this is not okay. Or bringing apartheid down in South Africa, or a peaceful end to strife in Northern Ireland, or the Berlin Wall coming down. It's that kind of movement that's needed. And I see people who are coming together to demand better by pulling together.
I see. Okay. And you talked about, you know, just the community here. This city is sometimes called Climate City.
Yeah.
We've got NOAA here. We've got you here. We've got the Collider here. What is it like for your colleagues? I mean, you're probably surrounded by all of these people who are doing this. I imagine it's very worrisome to people at NOAA, especially because there's so much uncertainty on the government side of things. Do you see a boost on the business end of things also?
Yeah, on the business end, I'm so lucky to be part of the Collider. And I know you spoke to James McMahon last week, and we have this growing group of entrepreneurs. And what's exciting about that is these are people who are figuring out ways to make sure that the world is resilient to what happens, so that agriculture knows what kind of plants to plant into the future when the ecosystems are different, or that you have an app on your phone that says if you are, you know, really sensitive to different climatic or weather conditions, you know this is a good day to go out or not go out, and on through all sorts of businesses, where we put our power plants and where we build our cities and how the coast handle it. So it's exciting to be part of a group of people who are making sure we're going to be okay in various very creative ways that seem like they have legs because they're part of businesses that will grow over time. So it's a hotbed of entrepreneurism over just around the corner. And I love being part of that. At the same time, as my company says, hey, we're going to prevent this stuff. It's not going to, we don't just want to be resilient and adapt. We want to make sure this is not an issue that our kids and grandkids are going to have to deal with this for the rest of their lives.
And what do you think, you know, you probably have contact with people over at NOAA. What do you think the mood is like over there down the street?
Yeah. Well, at NOAA, there's the very direct concern where the president-elect is talking about downsizing and getting rid of groups like NOAA. It's NASA that he's spoken about. You know, it's the equivalent, Bill McKibben said it well, you know, getting rid of the NASA climate observation capacity is like going through your house and taking all the fire extinguishers and throwing them out the door. You know, like we would have no ability to see what is actually happening to our world. So the scientists over there, I believe, are... they've been worried for 20 years about the climate. So that is not new. They've known these trends for a long time. And they're concerned that we're not going to be able to even measure what is going on if we continue down this road of chopping up all of the science that is behind our understanding of ecosystems and economies.
Your colleague, Ellie?
Was Ellie it? Johnston.
Ellie, yes. Johnston was giving a presentation when I visited the Collider, and you as well. And she was talking about the Marrakesh Climate Conference and how it started, and then the election of Donald Trump happened. And then the entire conference shifted, even in terms of what people presented. They had to sort of retool. What do you think internationally people's reaction to it were especially in Marrakesh at this, where people are making this happen?
So in Marrakesh, the election happened during the Marrakesh UN climate negotiations. And one of the most encouraging moments for me was soon after one of the Chinese delegates, one of the negotiators for China, got up and said, well, we understand that there will be a new president and there have been new presidents for many years, and we are going to keep our commitments and we're going to do what we always said we're going to do. This does not change things radically for us. And that was a strong theme there because U.S. is important, but we are not the center of this world. And other countries are realizing they need to take action for their own reasons. And U.S. leadership helps a lot, but it doesn't drive everything on its own. So this will continue. These commitments and this trend are going to be long-lasting and powerful.
I asked James McMahon the same thing, but you know, beyond what you do, what would you say to people who want to do their part as well, people who aren't in the climate change business?
There's so many people in Asheville who care so deeply about this international issue. And what people can do around here is at a variety of scales. And it's the two main ones are doing all you can. Ellie Johnston, my colleague at Climate Interactive, has figured out how to ride her bike to work. Every time I go to the Collider now, I don't take the elevator. I walk up the stairs. Why? Just a little bit of coal stays in the ground in West Virginia through Progress Energy Duke because I do that. So there's actions that we all take, and we all know they've been talking about that for 30 years. But more importantly, what we need to do is pull together in community. I mentioned my friend A.K. Benninghoffen, who pulled together 35 people on the whim to have coffee, eat donuts, and make phone calls to representatives. And what was beautiful about that is people pulling together and supporting each other and having it be fun and positive. We're getting together to do something. There's a group called Mothers Out Front in New England. They've been doing the same thing, getting people together to take collective action to resist the forces that are sending us in the wrong direction. So take your own action to reduce your energy use and make it greener. And then secondly, pull together in whatever fun, interesting ways. It doesn't have to be coffee and donuts. Mm. Whatever feels right to you. Oh, Monica, there was a mom in my neighborhood who just put out a table and said in the mornings for kids to go to school and said, let's all walk. Come here. I'll have donuts. They have a donut, walk to school. Little things of people taking action at whatever level they feel the best.
Kind of backtracking a little bit, when you had mentioned natural gas is one of the ways that we're sort of getting away from coal. Are you optimistic about natural gas? Because I've heard it's talked about reduced emissions, but of course there's the concern of methane. What do you think about that?
So natural gas is not a good transition fuel to get us to the low carbon world that we need to be in. We need to keep the natural gas safely in the ground. So when we get off of coal, we need to go directly to wind, solar, and use energy efficiency to cut energy demand. And it's not just because of methane. It's because natural gas has carbon in it. It's better than coal, but still we can't afford to dig up and burn all the natural, much of the natural gas that's out there. So that we should not transition towards natural gas. We should go right to renewables.
When I talk to people at Duke Energy, they often tell me that they are moving towards renewable energy. Obviously, it's not happening at as fast a pace that environmentalists want, but they say that oftentimes they'll come back to say that there's just, you can't do it. You can't get the industrial scale of power that our country needs by renewables alone. Is that correct or is that changing? Are we at the point now where we can power ourselves completely with renewables?
So all of the details haven't been worked out, but in general, we can do it. We can drive a really fast transition to renewables and faster than we are right now. Right now, cheap natural gas is making it really tempting not to really go for it and get our grid ready and to get our electricity generation and the markets and the business models that are needed. So we can do it, and we should be trying much harder, and we should be pressuring our electric utilities to try much harder because it is possible.
All right. Well, Drew, those are my questions. Yeah. Is there anything else that we didn't talk about that you think we should?
I think I just want to say it again, that I'm so amazed by the creativity of people in Asheville to make a contribution at whatever level they think is needed to address climate change. I was at the gym. I go to CrossFit, and this my friend Will Hamilton said, "Hey, I was part of like Yogis Beyond Coal, which is a group of people doing yoga beyond coal, like to address climate change and get rid of coal." And he said, "Now I'm thinking of like CrossFit people up beyond coal." And this isn't about CrossFit, or it's not about coal. It's about all the creativity of people thinking, at whatever scale they are, how can I contribute in some small way to what's really needed and do it with spirit and with fun and creativity? So I'm just in awe of the ways that people are stepping up to address this global challenge.
And you are still hopeful.
I'm still hopeful because I see so many people doing so much. I see the questions you're asking me right now. You could be talking about whatever's going on with celebrities or something, but you're really asking important questions that matter in the near term when it comes to the health of people here, but also in the long term. People will thank us for our vigilance today.
All right. Well, Andrew Jones, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, Jeremy. It was a pleasure to be here.